Government Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ecology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, John Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on VBSRadio.com. So nice to have you with us tonight on this July the 14th on the West Coast, already July the 15th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. Special thanks to Dr. Lynn Horwitz and Roxy Hampton, Reverend Roxy Hampton, for the plug on the show. Hope you stayed with us. And be sure to tune in to Dr. Len's show every Tuesday, 1 hour before this show begins. That's 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern Time, 11 Central, and 10 Mountain. Dr. Horowitz has been talking about this vaccine situation, and this is very, very important that you get this information wherever and whenever you can. That said, we're going to go right into tonight's show. We have a guest that's on this show every week, it seems like now, and we love having him on. I get a lot of response from the listeners. They appreciate the information that's coming out. He's got a popular website, educate-yourself.org. He is a researcher. He's an author, a journalist, metaphysician, a great investigator. He is a repository of information. He's got more stuff than most libraries, I can tell you. And if you want to compare books and articles and history, he's got a lot of the truth on his site. So, and I've been a visitor of his site for many years before we even met, and he had seen my work on my website, directlightproductions.com, and got really interested, and we hooked up, and here we are. We have a special guest tonight also, which we'll be bringing on in just a few moments. But first, I welcome back to Evident Footprints again my good friend, Mr. Ken Adachi. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Don. It's wonderful to be on with you again, and I truly appreciate these opportunities to have conversations with you. I find it very rewarding and gratifying. So thank you for offering me these many opportunities to speak with you on your show.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. And as I already mentioned, the listening audience loves having you on board. They're always wondering what we're going to talk about. And we're going to get into some deep issues tonight. You and I have done two or three shows already on the Dr. Jeffrey McDonald case. And we have Dr. McDonald's wife, Catherine, with us this evening. We're going to bring her on in a few minutes. But I wanted to give you an opportunity to give the listening audience a short recap on the particulars of the case, and then we'll bring Mrs. McDonald on. Okay?
Okay. Thank you. Yes, I'm really pleased to be able to return to the story of Dr. McDonald, and I feel very fortunate that we have Dr. McDonald's wife with us on the phone tonight, who is has a very, very detailed and careful background of the facts surrounding the case. I'm concerned about returning to the subject of the McDonald case because I feel it's probably the most grievous instance of judicial misconduct likely in the history, at least in the modern history of this country. You had a young doctor who had voluntarily joined the Army during the Vietnam War when the draft was on, And he was a dedicated American, as believed in the government, believed in the mission of America, believed in the Constitution, believed in all those virtues they teach us when we're in grammar school and high school, et cetera, about who Americans are and the role we've played in history. It's supposedly the defenders of truth, honor, and justice, and freedom, and democracy, and all that. I told you on earlier occasions that I, too, voluntarily joined the military for pretty much the same reasons. Sure, I wanted adventure and to get out of the house and see the world and all that, but I felt a sense of duty to the country. I was raised in a good family. I had a good life. We in this country have never been subject to the hardship of war, at least on the domestic front. So I felt fortunate, and I felt it was my duty. I'm sure Jeffrey McDonald felt exactly the same way. That's why most people volunteer for the military. It's a sense of both duty and a willingness to do your part when you're at the right age to join the military. And he had worked very hard to go through college, then he went through medical school. He married his high school sweetheart. While he was still going to college, they had a couple small children, two young girls. By the time he entered the Army, which I guess was in early 1969, he had gone through some training, and then by late fall of 69, he was assigned to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. A horrendous event occurred on the night of February 17th, 1970. His wife and his two kids were sleeping in the master bedroom. Jeffrey McDonald himself had fallen asleep on the couch in the living room. He was woken up approximately 2:15, 2:30 in the morning by three men hovering over them, one with a baseball bat, both threatening him and trying to communicate with him at the same time and assaulting him. He was enduring three simultaneously incongruent actions at the same time. I reviewed most of the history of the events that ensued in the house that night. His wife, Colette, and the two young children, the girls, were murdered by these intruders. The next morning, early in the morning, around 4:30 in the morning, the military police showed up at his house. They were able to resuscitate him, and he immediately started to tell the man who brought him around to check on his wife. He started to explain how they were attacked by these intruders. The Army decided in very short order to focus the investigation totally on Jeffrey McDonald, rather than even seriously attempt, to look for other suspects. They decided very early on in their so-called investigation that McDonald must have did it. He must have set the whole stage. And for some unexplained reason, he simply went berserk and decided to slaughter his family. He had an Army hearing in which he was acquitted of all charges. He was exonerated in every possible way. 5 years later, 1975, he was indicted by what formerly were elements in the Army who had attempted to prosecute him, had transferred to civilian life. They got a grand jury together. They indicted him. 4 years beyond that, 1979, he had the trial. He was convicted at the trial, given three consecutive life sentences. He's already served 30 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. And before we bring Mrs. McDonald on, I just want to emphasize something that every American who cares about the meaning of the words in the Constitution, the principles under which America was founded and we're supposed to hold as sacred, is the notion of truth, honor, and justice. And the people who are appointed to positions of authority and power to act as judges, act as prosecutors, act as Department of Justice attorneys, U.S. Attorney's Office, state attorney general's office, etc., they have the highest obligation of all to uphold those principles. And when those very elements, the ones who we turn to and expect to represent the words enshrined in the Constitution when it comes to truth and justice, we expect them, above all, as we do of the law enforcement personnel, to be the highest bearers of this integrity. And when those elements are corrupt, when those elements, for the purposes of power gain, for the purposes of hiding corruption among high officials, high organizations, when they use their positions of authority to subvert the Constitution, to railroad an innocent man, as they have done with Jeffrey McDonnell, it's an outrage that we, the American people, must bring to an end. I can't think of one case that epitomizes this miscarriage of justice, this railroading of an innocent American man who is loyal to the country, who volunteered to serve the country, who was serving the country in a very diligent and high-capacity manner, to be abused by the very government that he was prepared to put his life on the line for, is something that we, the American people, must rectify. So without further ado, I'll turn it back to you, Don, to introduce Mrs. McDonnell, and we can talk about those elements that she wishes to discuss about the latest development in the case.
Well, thank you, Ken. Thank you for that wonderful synopsis. If no one had ever heard of this case, they certainly have a great idea of what has occurred. You know my feelings about the Justice Department, and it's kind of an oxymoron that they call themselves the Justice Department when you're describing the injustice that has been done. I'll save my rant for later on. Right now. Ladies and gentlemen, I am now going to introduce our second guest on tonight's show. She has not been on this show before, but I have the sneaking suspicion that she will be on again. This won't be her only visit here to Evident Footprints. Mrs. Catherine, or I should say Mrs. Jeffrey McDonald. Mrs. McDonald, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I know you have a lot to say, and I know because this case is about to move into a hearing within the next few weeks, I understand. I don't know the exact date, but maybe you could fill us in a little bit on where things stand right now, because we're talking about many years of this injustice being drug out and your husband has not been afforded his day in court as it's presented on TV in all of these shows that we get conditioned by. It's quite a different scenario out there in real life, isn't it?
Yes, it definitely is. And, of course, I haven't lived it as long as Jeff has, but I have lived it for quite a long time, 12, 13 years now. And we've been married for 7 years.
Okay, excuse me, Mrs. McDonald, I have to ask you to speak up just a little bit more.
Can you hear me better now?
Yes, that's better.
Okay, yeah, I just need to, I'm sorry.
Get mad. Don't be afraid to get mad.
No, I was saying that Jeff has lived this for 39 years, and I've lived it for almost 13. We've been married for 7 years, and it never ceases to amaze me what the Justice Department will do, what lengths they will go to at least in this case, it's very clear that they're not interested in getting to the truth. They're actually adopting what are typically defense tactics to keep evidence away and keep it separate from other components so that you can't put the puzzle together, because if you do, then the outcome is that people will realize that there is overwhelming evidence of Jeff's innocence, where they've built their case on this idea of this quote, mountain of evidence of his guilt. But even those items that they supposedly said proved his guilt, when you look at them closely, they're either false or were based on false data, or they are as probative of innocence as they are of guilt, so they're neutral. It's all circumstantial, but they have a lot invested in this. This is a 39-year-old case, and the fact that we are at the juncture that we're at after all these many years is very telling just in that fact that the courts and the most conservative appeals court in our country, the Fourth Circuit, would take another look at this case when other cases are closed after two appeals, and we're on our fifth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, please remember to speak up a little bit more, because we're kind of losing you there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I will speak. Is this better?
Yes, that's much better. Thank you.
Okay, I'll speak louder. People in this country, the presumption of innocence is, in my mind, just a really false
presumption
that people are under. That people think, oh yes, oh well, you know, until you're convicted, you are considered innocent. But as soon as you're brought in as a suspect, you know, the presumption is that there's a reason that the government has to bring you in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the burden falls on you to prove that you're innocent. And in Jeff's case, it was very, very, I mean, it was egregious the way it was set up for him to prove that he was innocent, not that he was, that they could prove that he was guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And so after all these years, to think that the very court that stated at some point, the quote, at some point the decision must be final, that they are revisiting this case after all these years is just remarkable and wonderful.
Yes. Now I've done a number of shows over the past 2 years on court corruption, and it's all over the country. This is not a unique case in the sense that corrupt things go on in the court. It's almost like both sides are playing on the same team. And, or maybe I should say it's both sides playing on the same team, and leave the word almost out of it. I know many attorneys. I have a very good attorney on this show from time to time, Carl Pearson out of New York. And he's in the court, so he really can't speak down to the court. There's a certain protocol of respect that you have to maintain. And he practices before the Supreme Court, and he takes on big corporations. And he's basically stated it. I've had to get out my pry bar and shimmy it a little bit to get him to, you know, to be a bit more vehement in his remarks, but he is absolutely brilliant, and he knows what's going on. He knows that this system has been corrupted from one end to the other. So we trust that God is watching what's going on, and that God will intercede in these events. We don't see it as the gloom and doom that 39 years would certainly paint. The picture that paints is horrible. And I remember your husband's case, reading about it in the press years ago when it first came out, and my reaction was that something was wrong. I had this gut feeling that something was not right. The injuries that he suffered alone were impossible. And as one becomes a researcher and researches how they get rid of people, putting them in prison is one way they do it. And if he knew of corruption, and this happens to many whistleblowers, they know of corruption and they have an agreement not to talk about this for 30 years until after they're out of their job. They're assuming that by that time most of the people that are culpable and whatever that the situation is are not even going to be around anymore. So they put these ridiculous time frames around when people can speak, and it shouldn't even be that. They should be able to speak the truth in 1 second after discovering what the truth is. So this is all contrived to protect people. And, you know, let the hammer fall where it may. That's my opinion. I'm sharing, you know, my disgust and my anger that to even contemplate that somebody would go through that. You know, my heart goes out to you. My heart goes out to your husband. That's why I was willing to have you on the show, to let people know the kind of injustice that's going on, because they will write about these things, or they'll publicize it when it's convenient for them to get a message across, to cause people to believe that everything is okay, when in reality we know that there are some very dark things going on out there. There are people that practice Satanism. We know they're in the military. They're in the intelligence agencies. They're even in the court system. And these things really have nothing to do with your husband's innocence, other than that they're covering this up, you see. They don't want that to get out. So they have a lot of problems that can happen because of what they've done. And they should be responsible for what they've done. So,
well, I think that our new Attorney General, Eric Holder, is doing remarkable things to now infiltrate the Justice Department and make people accountable. I mean, it's really telling to think that prosecutors who are attorneys and that were supposedly educated in law school are now going through classes to be educated on what is exculpatory evidence. What is it that they are required to give over to the defense? That they're required to give over any evidence that may help the defense. And they're now saying, oh, I didn't know that this was something I should have given over. Now,
well, it's always been that. I mean,
but now they're giving classes in that. Oh, you know, well, of course, that's been the law, but the prosecutors are being found to be negligent of not giving over evidence that does not support their theory of a case. They're saying, oh, I didn't know. And so they're now taking classes on what is exculpatory evidence, and that's something you're taught in, I'm sure, law class 101.
Well, yeah, you don't even have to be an attorney to recognize that if you know something about what happened in a case, if there's a witness that comes forward that exonerates the defendant, that person should be heard. What's wrong with the right thing occurring? You know, the outcome.
They're trained to win at any cost. And
yes.
And I don't just say that from my own point of view. I have been told that by a prosecutor in my husband's case, Jim Blackburn, who's since been disbarred. I met with him, and he told me that my husband's case was not about whether he was innocent or guilty. It was about winning. And that's what they're trained to do. And now I see the lengths that we're gone to procure that conviction. I mean, they were not going to. My husband, as Ken said, was exonerated by the Army, and in order to try him by a different branch of the government, they were not going to lose. They're not going to, you know, take 10 years to build a case and then lose. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Jeff went in there thinking, well, I'm innocent, and all I have to do is tell the truth, and the truth will out. Well, he's very naive.
Yes. Now, if I can mention, and Ken, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to recall that Ted Gunderson got involved in this case. And Ted's been on this show before, too, Catherine, so you know. I've talked to him. And certainly he's expert on some of the things going on behind the scenes, some of the things that went on behind the scenes 39 years ago. He's been very outspoken about that and involved in many, many cases. One that comes to mind is the McMartin case in California.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, Ted was a very respected head of the FBI, at one point in his career, a very respected person, and as often happens with people who defend Jeffrey McDonald, my husband, they are painted out as somehow, you know, being off, not knowing the facts. Something's wrong with them if they defend Jeff. And he's not the only person, but I know that Mr. Gunderson did very fine work on this case when he came into it, and the very government that he worked for, just like Jeff worked for the government, and other witnesses that have come forward, including Jimmy Britt, the U.S. Marshal, who reopened this case, then the government turns on them, and they're no longer credible because they are not, they've decided to try to call an end to what they've seen as what's wrongdoing.
Yes. Well, let's pray that that's the case. No pun intended with the word case there. Ken, do you want to comment on any of this?
Because I would like to just add a few, well, perhaps an amplification of what the Mrs. McDonald just said. There is this tactic, as you know, Don, that anytime anyone, especially someone who's already has a recognized rank, as it were, with the government, if you get on the side of the defendant, you know, the guy that the government's trying to put the screws to, they almost always will turn on that supporter in a way that they will use ad hominem attacks. They'll always pull out the, oh, he's a wing nut, he's a conspiracy nut card in every single instance. That's standard operation procedure for them. And for them to play that card with Ted Gunderson, of all people, he, prior to his retirement, he was very seriously considered to be the replacement of the FBI. He was a contender for J. Edgar Hoover's job prior to his retirement, which I mentioned earlier, occurred in early 1979. And Ted played a very pivotal role, I believe, in, above all, convincing Jerry Potter, one of the co-authors of the very important book, Fatal Justice, into looking into the case. And because of Ted's files, the information that Ted presented to Jerry, which occurred in 1985 in San Francisco when he met him up there at a, in Chinatown at a restaurant. That information got Jerry to seriously begin looking into the case. He hooked up with Fred Boss, I guess a couple years later, and they started very diligently to digging into every aspect of this case, and their book, Fatal Justice, is simply an extraordinary tour de force of investigative work. They have taken the fabrications, the misdirection, the falsities, these straw men arguments that was created by the prosecution at the trial and later by author Joe McGinnis in his book, Fatal Vision, and they thoroughly ventilated the truth of the matter in every single instances that they were, quote, using certain points to indicate or to try to say that Jeff was guilty of this crime. So my hat goes off to Ted Gunderson. I would have never known about this case if it wasn't for Ted bringing it up at the beginning of his lectures. He always brings up the McDonald case at the beginning of every single lecture he's done, and he's been doing that since, you know, early 1980, 1981, when he started to do these lectures. I'd just like to say
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Kathy.
Ken, I was just going to make a comment about Fatal Justice, and that is that you are absolutely correct that the authors took almost a dozen years to what they basically did was take the government's case and dissect it using the government's own documents to dismantle their case. The problem was, the reason in my mind, I mean, I read Fatal Justice and couldn't put it down, but most people found it very dry and hard to get through because it is so factual. And it says something about our culture and our society that people were much more drawn to Fatal Vision, even though that was a novel parading as nonfiction, and was proven as such in court. But it was titillating. It was like something you could read while you're at the beach that summer. And it was a bestseller. And I feel like this case is about the truth hiding in plain sight. It's easier for them to believe, the general public to believe, they'd rather believe that an ordinary, outstanding citizen, but an ordinary person, would go off and go berserk for 5 minutes, never to be seen before ever again, than that someone would be imprisoned wrongfully for reasons that can be debated. And mm-hmm. why would that happen? It's easier to believe he's guilty. Why would the government do this? Why would this happen to someone? Why would they be so vehement? And so Fred and Jerry's book was really, because it wasn't a narrative, it was very factual. It was more like a textbook. It just didn't, except for people who were really into finding out the truth, you know, really just never, it didn't have the visceral impact that Fatal Vision did, unfortunately, which I still hear about to this day, you know, and I meet people and they identify with me and or know who I am, who my husband is and like that, and they remember that. They remember that stupid miniseries that was, you know, really overdramatic and really badly done, if you ask me. But people from a certain generation remember it and think that's the facts.
And yeah, that's a topic we talk about a lot on this show. What you're describing is propaganda. The reason for the series to come out was to cause people to believe that was a true story, and they see it acted out before them, and it really leaves a deep impression, and they rely on their ignorance. You see, the media didn't report the truth on what happened either, you see. So you have a second reinforcement of the first lie. And then all of the hearings that he underwent, all his appeals, and how they turned out, it's a very serious problem. I don't intend to belittle your husband's situation, but this has happened to many people, and it's still going on today.
It's just the people who have been exonerated, over 200 in just the past year. That's just the tip of the iceberg. That's just the number of people who have somehow waded through the abyss and surfaced somehow after 10, 12, 18, 20 years. And then you take a case that has been publicized like Jeff's has, it's 100 times even more difficult because, the thought that you could, that a person was wrongly convicted and has spent 30 years in prison for something they didn't do, who is and always was so promising and had so much to offer and saved lives and could have done much more if he were free, it's easier to think, well, the right thing was done and we don't want to go there. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, and also with, you know, the government's liability on as far as having done the wrong thing.
Yes.
It's very, we don't care. I mean, I don't want anything. I just want my husband to come home. But I know that for them to, for the government to admit they did the wrong thing, would be very difficult for them to do, because then they'd have to admit they were wrong and that they were there then, the cause of all this. And,
yes.
you know, the only thing that I take heart in is Jeff being such a remarkable person that he has all the hallmarks of a truly innocent person, and I've met many of them over the years because of my experience of being involved and knowing my husband, and that is that he's not bitter. He just wants to come home. He's very optimistic. He's never lost hope that the truth will come out. He has never wavered from his story from day one. He was eligible for parole for 14 years and never went because he thought he would have to say that he was guilty to be considered, and he wouldn't do it because he's not. So he's had this unwavering faith and in the truth of his innocence, and I just don't think that I think it's to take the very rare person, he's one of them, who could stand up to 30 years of wrongful incarceration knowing someday, somehow, some way, the truth is going to come out, and that's what's happening now.
Well, Ken and I are going to do our best to help out in whatever way we can. You know, I've read what Ken has written, and Ken has shared personally with me, and I think with our listening audience on the past shows, some things about the character of your husband, in that he's helped other inmates within the prison in a medical capacity, using, you know, applying his medical knowledge, his love for his vocation. And to consider that's been robbed from him after the years of study and preparation for that, and really not doing anything wrong, not having committed any crime, and having to go through that, is, you know, there are all these emotions that flow through me, anger, and sadness, and this spirit of determination to want to help. You know, I'm in a position to do that, at least with this show, to get the truth out. Is there anything that you think people out there who are listening to this, to what you have to say, you know, short of prayer, is there anything that people could do to assist you?
Well, with the case being in front of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Senate and the House of Representatives, the Congress cannot get involved because sort of a petition or anything like that is not valuable at this juncture. It's in the hands of the court, and the Congress can't interfere with that, as long, you know, it's before a court, and that's an amazing fact right there. I would think that people's thoughts and best wishes. We do have the McDonald Defense Fund, which is a nonprofit 501c3 corporation, tax exempt organization, to help the wrongly convicted. Is a place that people can donate to if they want to help defray the costs, enormous costs, of trying to defend someone who's been wrongly incarcerated, and you're trying to prove your factual innocence. As you and Ken both know, the federal government has it's a behemoth with a bottomless pit, and an ordinary citizen like myself, where my husband, you know, he's a doctor, and every cent he ever made has been drained, and I am a drama teacher. I have a drama school for children, and I'm no match for the federal government, and they kind of, as part of the game, is that everyone's on one side except the defendant, and it's who can outlast the other person. And, well, it's not even a contest, so you go to whatever means you have to go to friends, to anyone, and exhaust all your own resources just to fight the fight. And it shouldn't be that way, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
The deck shouldn't be stacked against you financially, and literally, where, you know, the courts and the prosecutors are on one side, and they're all with the government, you're alone, And in Jeff's case, it's gone on so long, and there, you know, so many ironies that you, just to back up for a moment, you were talking about how, about Jeff being able to use his medical skills, in the prison setting. And, many people might not be aware that, if you are become incarcerated, if you're a lawyer, you can practice law in prison. You can fight your own case. You can help other inmates fight their cases. But if you are a doctor or a dentist, you cannot practice medicine or dentistry in prison. However, if they need you to do something, then you're a doctor. But you're not a doctor otherwise. In fact, you know, Jeff's been told many, many times, you know, you're not a doctor here. And the irony there, I mean, many years ago now, but he never does give advice to other people, other inmates or like that, because he's not allowed to. He'll get, you know, he'll be put in solitary confinement or whatever if he does such a thing.
I see.
Except when there's been someone who's dying and the people on the staff don't know what to do, then he's the first person they go to. And, in fact, the night that Fatal Vision first aired, the first installment, it was, I think, 4 or 5 nights when the miniseries first aired.
Mm-hmm.
The first night that it aired, Jeff was in prison in Texas, and an inmate had swallowed a bag of heroin, and it, you know, exploded or whatever in his esophagus or his abdominals, and he was dying. And so the miniseries is on TV, and they call Jeff to come rescue this guy, another inmate, which he did. And it was in the newspapers at the time, Fatal Vision Doctor Saves Inmate's Life, and that was during this telecast. Isn't that strange? But another time later on, another inmate was passing Jeff on a pass where they go between movements when they have movement between, they have, you know, regulated movements on the hour and so forth. And he was on crutches and he was just limping along, and they all call Jeff Doc. Even the officers and the staff call Jeff Doc. Everyone in prison has a nickname. And this man stopped him and said, Doc, you know, my leg is really hurting me, even though I'm on these crutches. I just, you know. And Jeff said, well, your crutches aren't the right height. And he leaned down to adjust the man's crutches. Now, if he weren't a doctor, like if I were in prison or you were in prison and you leaned down and said, well, let me adjust your crutches, that would have not been any kind of infraction. So at the same time they're saying he's not a doctor, because he really is a doctor, within the prison, they arrested him for practicing medicine by adjusting this man's crutches and put him in solitary confinement for 30 days. I didn't know what had happened to him. I was scared to death.
It's too bad he didn't study veterinary medicine, because they're animals. The people you're describing, you know, and that's just my opinion. So.
Well, it was a horrible, you know, I didn't know what had happened to him. I couldn't get anyone to tell me what had happened. And, you know, after some time, maybe a week, he got out a letter, you know, written in pencil. He's being fed through a food slot in a cell, allowed to exercise 15 minutes 3 times a week in a cage and take a shower for 5 minutes 3 times a week because he adjusted this man's crutches when he's supposedly not a doctor. So, but when someone, you know, is going to die, then he can be a doctor. So it's really, it's very frustrating for him, because it's really in his soul, in his nature. It's like how you feel, you're drawn to your job and your avocation. He is a healer. He is a person who, and I know he went into emergency medicine after the deaths of his family, his wife and his children. He was going to be an orthopedist, but he went into emergency medicine, I think kind of subconsciously, because he had a desire to save lives. And orthopedists, you know, as great as they are, they don't save lives. They relieve pain. But in an emergency room setting, you know, he was constantly saving people's lives in emergencies, and it's something he was not able to do for his own family because he was knocked unconscious. And it always bothers me when people say, well, you know, he was the strongest person in the household and he didn't die, so that says something there. And I think to myself, well, Superman couldn't save you if he was unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctors, as you said earlier, the medical records, any fair reading of the medical records, and even the trial testimony, the government's own doctors said that the blow Jeff suffered to his head, much less the stab wounds and punctured lung and so forth, would render a person unconscious. And they said that. And yet, somehow that didn't resonate. That the story that came out was that he had minor injuries, that he, you know, he was in the ICU for 9 days, and, you know, he had 2 surgeries, and he would have done anything to save his family. And he still, it's taken him years to come to terms with the fact that, you know, he was the strongest, and he was knocked unconscious and was unable to help them. And because he lived, therefore that somehow equates with guilt. I don't get that at all, but that's, you know, sort of how these myths of the case that our government has helped perpetuate, and anyone who comes in the way of those myths, including myself, is therefore, you know, needs to be discredited, is delusional, crazy, or got it wrong, or has another motive, when the truth is, well, let me just put it this way. The closing argument from the prosecutor, Jim Blackburn, who's now been disbarred on 12 felony counts of dishonesty back in the, after the case, after he was elevated to U.S. attorney for the state of North Carolina because he won Jeff's case, he closed his arguments by saying, things don't lie, but people can and do. And he was saying basically that the facts of the case, the forensic evidence that the government had presented were facts, and they were things that couldn't be denied, and that Jeff was lying. And the irony there is that his statement is true. Things don't lie, and people can and do. But the point is that the things didn't lie. They were lied about because the government manipulated them, and left out things or added things or changed things to make it look a certain way. And people do lie, but it wasn't Jeff lying. It was Blackburn.
Yeah, and that's called obstruction of justice. And there are probably some other torts there. But you see, it's okay to make the lie that incriminates a person, and they get away with it in the very place where justice is to occur. Now, we're trying to get Ken back on here, if you can excuse me one moment. Seth, if you're listening, we lost Ken Adachi. Can you get him back on the air for us? We'll roll on here now until Ken joins us. But, you know, what goes through my mind, Mrs. McDonald, is not just the injustice that's been done. Has any of this come out in the appeals, the work that he's doing? I say the work that he's doing. It's, you know, these summons to come and help in these emergency situations. Has anyone acknowledged that in a public forum other than on a radio show like this, or if it even gets acknowledged at all? I don't know. I'm speculating there.
Well, when he saved the life of the inmate the night that Fatal Vision first aired on television, I think that was 1984 or something, that was in the newspapers. Of course, when he was free, the 10 years between the time that the tragedy occurred in February 17th of 1970 and the trial in 1979, he saved so many lives that he lived in, you know, Long Beach, California, and the police association there made him the first honorary member of the police force there because he saved so many police officers' lives. I mean, actually, on several occasions, including one that I know specifically the details on, where there was a man holding his family hostage in the house, and the police approached, and a police officer was gunned down in the driveway, and they called Jeff because they always knew Jeff would come, and Jeff came, and without, you know, anything, no protection, nothing, just went to aid this officer in the driveway. He could have been shot dead, and aided him, resuscitated him, and got him into an ambulance at the risk of his own life. So the police force made him the first honorary member of their force, because he'd saved so many police officers' lives. And this was a man who was lied about by the military police. But he's not a person who looks back, he looks forward. And I think that was also something that was difficult, as far as dealing, like, with his parents-in-law. His stepfather, Colette's stepfather, they chose to express their grief in a very different way than Jeff. And for anyone to say, well, if it were me, I would do this. And so since Jeff didn't act this way or that way, therefore, you know, that means something. I mean, grief is very, very personal, and Jeff is a military person. Jeff was brought up in a very strict household, and he was not a person who wore his emotions on his sleeve, and his way of coping with tragedy was, in my mind, a healthy way, was to try to be useful, productive, bury his troubles in working and helping other people. And, you know, his in-laws were the opposite. They boarded themselves up in their house and closed the curtains and visited the graves every day. And you look back that Jeff was 26 years old at that time. For him to want to get a new start and just put the past behind him and try to build a new life, I don't think that that's wrong at all. I think it's healthy, much healthier than not moving on with your life. And he's never, ever forgotten his family or his love for them or wished that none of this ever happened. It's just not something he's expressed publicly all the time, and somehow that's come back to make him look somehow like he didn't care or whatever. And it's just simply not true. And I know him like I know myself, and the fact that he wasn't a person who would go public with that type of thought, and not someone who easily expressed emotion, and sat at a trial where his lawyers were telling him, stay calm and don't look at anyone a certain way, stay calm, keep your face straight. That's what they were telling him, and he was doing what he thought, you know, was the best thing to do, but some people read that as that he didn't care, or he was cold, or he couldn't win, really. And if you look at it, if he cried, then they said it was crocodile tears, and if he was stoic, then they said he was cold. And I don't think anyone could ever put themselves in his position and imagine how they would react under such circumstances, but people do all the time.
Yes, I can say, just from contemplating what that might be like, I've lost family members just through, through life, you know, the ones passing, maybe in a what we would call natural death, although I don't really think there is such a thing as a natural death, but certainly not in the way his family was taken from him, and the way his life was taken from him. I mean, you know, when we lose a loved one, we have to get on with life. And I can understand his attitude of just wanting to move forward and putting all this behind him. But I'm sure he's probably described nightmares of what happened to him. He was severely injured. This was not a simple matter. In fact, what I think it's important to remind the listeners about is the fact that he was stabbed, what is it, 17 times, and he was hit several times over the head with either a baseball bat or some sort of a club, something that was used as a club. Not the kind of injuries one could inflict upon themselves, let's say.
No. And even government doctors, if anyone took the time to read the transcript of the trial, which is 10,000 pages long, but I've been through it many, many times because I became paralegal 9 years ago to try to aid the attorneys, because of financial constraints and so forth, and also, you know, wanting to be able to be more effective rather than just, on my own, you know what I mean? As far as being helpful in any way that I could be. But I'm saying, going back to the trial transcript, even the government doctors and experts, they would say, could somebody stab themselves in this way and be sure that they wouldn't kill themselves? And they all said, no, you couldn't. You could not be sure. And they're like, well, and then they asked the government doctors, well, this contusion on his head, was that consistent with someone, was it the kind of injury that would render you unconscious? And when you read the transcript, which you never hear about, but I've read it, the army doctors are saying, yes, it's consistent with being knocked out cold. And that's exactly what happened to him. And when I had the opportunity to speak with Helena Stokely, the key witness at the trial, who was, as I know you and Ken have discussed previously, threatened into changing her testimony on the stand, which is, you know, one of the major issues at stake right now, her mother told me the whole story from Helena's viewpoint, and it was like I was sitting there reliving what Jeff had been through, because it was, she never met Jeff, and yet, you know, all these years later, Helena's mother could recount a story that was almost exact to the word of what Jeff said happened, but from Helena's viewpoint, her daughter's viewpoint, including that two men beat him down with a bat or a club. That's what her mother told me. Her mother was very frail physically, but she was very, very sharp. She had all her mental faculties, and